What drove the world to hate the epitome of love? When you read in the Gospel according to John, and you come across chapter 6, you'll read there where Jesus had 5,000 men following him. He then said some things that offended them, and all of them left him, except 12. But as we go further into the story of Jesus, now in John chapter 7, we discover that some people are not content to simply walk away from Jesus. Some set their hearts on his destruction. Let's see what happens next in John chapter 7. Verse 1 says this: After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. After losing 5,000 disciples and being left with only 12, interestingly, Jesus decided to stay in that area, which was Galilee, where all these things have been taking place. He was not so disgusted with the area, and he says, well, I'll never go back there again. You know, like how we might do if people treat us bad. You know, we'll never go back to that restaurant, or we'll never go back into that town. And we may even speak bad about it to others. But Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus did not have a serve me mentality. He didn't come into a place and say, now let's see how people are going to treat me. Jesus did not come to serve or to be served, but to serve. But also John indicates here in John 7:1 that he stayed in Galilee because if he went down into Judea, the Jews would seek to kill him. Now Jesus did not fear death, but the time of his death had not arrived. And Jesus would die according to the timing of God, not according to the fanatical hate of men. Oh, he'll be ready to die when the time comes. It just wasn't that time. Now, John continues to write this, verses 2 through 5. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. His brothers therefore said to him, Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. And then John added, For even his brothers did not believe in him. The Passover was in chapter 6. So about 6 months had transpired from chapter 6 to chapter 7 because the Feast of Tabernacles was about 6 months after the Feast of Passover. The Passover commemorated the passing over of the Lord. When Israel was still in Egypt and the Lord passed over their homes, and if he saw blood across the top of the door and down the sides, then he went on. He passed over. But when he came to a home where the blood was not across the top and not down the sides from a lamb, and that would be the homes of the Egyptians, he then sent the destroyer down into the home and took the life of the firstborn in that family. Now, as you know, God, through Moses, eventually delivered Israel out of the land of Egypt and took them into the wilderness on their way to their own land, their own country, the land of Canaan. And while there, God set up a feast known as the Feast of Tabernacles. This here was to commemorate that 40-year time period as they wandered in the wilderness between Egypt and going into the land of Canaan. They didn't build homes during that time, but rather they lived in tents or booths, or another word would be tabernacle. And so every year, the Israelites were to remember the wilderness wanderings of their forefathers and mothers, and they were to leave their homes and go camp in a tent for a while and remember what it had been like. And so that's what's happening here. Passover's now done, chapter 6. 6 months pass, and now we're in chapter 7, and it's the Feast of Tabernacles. But his brothers said, you need to go to this feast. Any teacher, any leader in Israel is going to go to Jerusalem and obey the law of Moses so that his disciples, Jesus, can see the works that he's doing. That you're not contrary to the law of Moses, and that you're going to encourage everyone to keep the law. In other words, a teacher of religion is not going to hide his obedience, Jesus. So his brothers, that would be James, Joses, Simon, and Judas, who later became known as Jude, and you can wonder why, told him to show himself to the world. It just didn't make sense to his brothers for a teacher of his stature to remain in Galilee while this huge feast was going on in Jerusalem. Then John added in verse 5 that the four brothers of Jesus did not believe in him. I think perhaps then they were testing him or challenging him. They just didn't believe that he was the Lord, that he was the Christ of the Old Testament. Now, let's put ourselves in their position. Those four brothers, plus he had some sisters, would we have believed him? Would we have believed that our older brother, our humble older brother, working in dad's business, was the Lord of heaven and earth, the Son of God, who was the Christ of the Old Testament? There was nothing about him during those three decades that would make them think, oh, he's really special. There's something really different about him. We see that he is destined for this. No, for those three decades, or less for them actually, since they were born after him. But his catapult from obscurity to fame and celebrity, they had a hard time accepting that. This is just Jesus, our older carpenter brother. We don't understand all this fuss that's being made about him. So they didn't believe. However, they kept their eyes on him. And I think what's happening here in John chapter 7 shows that. Everyone in Israel in those days knew about Jesus of Nazareth, including his family. They saw him. And what he did, they heard what he preached, and they heard things being said about him. And eventually, things changed. Acts chapter 1 shows us that after Jesus ascended to heaven, his 11 apostles returned to Jerusalem. And they went there and waited for about 10 days. They didn't know why they were waiting. Jesus just told them to go there and wait. And while there, they were with some other disciples. And Acts 1:14 says this, these all, that is the 11 apostles, continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. They eventually became believers, or at least two of them. Brothers is, you know, plural, it has to be at least two. And we know of at least two who did become believers. So much so that one of them, the oldest of those four, James, became a prominent member, a prominent leader in the church in Jerusalem, and he wrote the book that is named after him. And the other brother, probably the very youngest one, Judas, whose name became Jude, We know he wrote that little tiny book called Jude. So what a transformation happened with those men. Isn't family sometimes the hardest to convert? We've all had some of those experiences. But follow the example of Jesus, and perhaps in time, maybe, you'll see conversions in your family as he did. Jesus did not harp on them, but continued to live the life of God before them, and at least some of them, if not all of them, couldn't resist it. Now in verses 6 through 8 of John 7, John continued. Then Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I am not yet going up to this feast, for my time is not yet fully come." He could not go then because his time had not arrived. Their time was always ready because God always wanted them to obey him. So as good Jewish males, they needed to go to Jerusalem three times a year, and one of them, I believe, was during the time of Tabernacles. So it was good for them to go. His time to be glorified through his death would come later. Their time of glory through obedience was at the present. And he explained in verse 7 why their times were different. While their time for glory was now, but his time for glory was later. He said the world did not hate them because they did not testify of the world's evil. Whereas he did testify of the world's evil. And the world still hates Jesus for the same reason. He did not psychologize sin. He didn't excuse evil. He didn't join in wickedness. He did not approve or tolerate of the world's unrighteousness. He stood against anyone who stood against the laws of God. And they hated him and his church for the same reason. Therefore, he told his brothers to go up to the feast. He was not going then because his time had not fully come. His time would arrive. And when it did, he would face death with such boldness that the men who went to arrest him, he went right out there and encountered them, confronted them. "Who are you seeking?" "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "I'm he." They were so shocked that he would not run and hide, but come right out and meet them boldly, that the Bible says they literally fell down back on the ground, and they got back up, and he says, "Who are you looking for?" "Jesus of Nazareth." "I'm he." "Let these go," his disciples. And they arrest him. So Jesus doesn't fear death. It's all about timing. Jesus went to the feast, but he delayed, verses 9 and 10. When he said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were, in secret. He continued longer in Galilee. After his brothers left, he then went up to the feast. However, he didn't do so openly as his brothers wanted him to go, but he went secretly. See, if he had gone with his brothers, then everyone would have recognized him immediately. And he couldn't have that right now. So he needed to still get to Jerusalem because he had important things to do while there. Now look at the opinions that people had of Jesus, 11 through 13. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, "He is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Although he was incognito at the feast, he was the talk of the town. People fully expected him to be there, probably for the same reason as his brothers expected him to be there. Now notice that some of the people were complaining about him. Like when anyone becomes a leader or a teacher and people automatically complain, believing it's their duty to do so. You're a leader, I'm supposed to criticize you. And you're supposed to take it. Others confess, he's good. They saw what he did. They heard what he said. And they did not see and they did not hear evil. They saw and they heard good. And they're thinking to themselves, he's a good man. And with those people, their opinion of him will grow to where they understand him to be more than just good. But still others disagreed with that, complaining that he deceived the people. Now it's true, a deceiver makes things, including himself, look good. But usually has an ulterior motive and tries to get things out of people or does something evil to the people. But Jesus didn't do either one of those things. He wasn't building wealth from the people. And what evil did he do to them? Not a thing. Interestingly, both groups did not speak publicly about him, fearing reprisals from the Jews. So that even those who complained may not have liked Jesus, but they certainly didn't want to do him any harm. They thought he was a problem, but they're going to remain silent. Then look what happens in 14 and 15. Now, about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? Suddenly, this man who's been in secret, suddenly he goes up into the temple and starts teaching publicly. Because he knows he won't be arrested in a situation like that. If he had gone with his brothers and people had recognized him right away, then they could arrest him away from the crowds and there'd be no problem. Now that he's in front of everyone, these Jewish leaders are not about to make a huge scene and go up there and arrest him because they know the people like him and now they'll have all the people against them. So Jesus knew what he was doing. And his teaching impressed them because he knew things, but he didn't sound like a scholar. It wasn't dry, and he wasn't just giving them a bunch of useless facts that they couldn't really do anything with those facts in life. He wasn't comparing what this scholar said with what this commentator said and all that kind of stuff. He spoke as a man of the street. In fact, you've probably heard the New Testament was written in Greek. You've probably even heard that it was originally written in Koine Greek. What does it mean, Koine Greek? What were these people speaking that we find here in the New Testament? Koine means common. The original language of the New Testament was not the ivory tower scholar type of person. It was street language. You're reading street language in these last 27 books of the Bible. And Jesus was speaking like that. He wanted the man on the street to understand what he was saying because he came for the man on the street. He came for all people. He spoke well and he spoke accurately. But he didn't sound like a nitpicking Pharisee. He was not pompous trying to impress people, with his knowledge, but he cared for the people, and they could tell that. And he reverenced the Word of God, and they could tell that too. So they're saying, how does this man know what he's speaking about so well, but it's obvious he doesn't have a bunch of letters after his name? Well, he explains why he was able to speak the way he was. Verses 16 through 18. Jesus answered them and said, my doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine, whether it is from God or whether I speak on my own authority. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. But he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. To answer the question of how he could know letters, although not having attended any of their schools, he explained that, well, he just didn't come up with the doctrine that he taught. He repeated what the Father told him to speak. Son, say this. He came down here and said that. The Father spoke it. Jesus repeated it. It can't get much easier than that. Jesus did not put his own spin, interpretation, or commentary on the Father's doctrine, but just spoke what the Father originated. So that's why he sounded so good when he spoke. He's speaking the words of the God of heaven. You better believe that's going to sound good. But maybe someone says, now how could anyone know back then or today that Jesus did not teach his own doctrine, but rather the one who sent him? Well, in verse 17, he revealed how you can know. It's not an intellectual matter, but it's a matter of the desire, okay? Jesus didn't come to give us all an intellectual test. He didn't speak to try and find out how smart we are, but how much we desire to know God's will. Do you desire to know God's will? Do you have that determination? Well, he said you can examine his teachings and know from where he got his doctrine. You will know whether it came from God the Father or whether he invented it on his own. And then he gave what is really a sensible test in verse 18. The one who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. Listen to Jesus as you read through the New Testament. And say, is this man seeking his own glory? Or is he trying to seek the glory of the one who sent him? He really made it sound like it's that easy. So which did Jesus do? Did he seek his own glory? Or did he seek the glory of someone else, the one who sent him? Now watch what he says in 19 and 20. Did not Moses give you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me? Then John comments, the people answered and said, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? I like the way Jesus did that there. He turned the tables on them. They had opinions about him, they had questions for him, and they had accusations against him. And he turns it back on them because they sought to kill him. Moses gave them the law. They think he's not keeping the law, but actually they were the ones who were not keeping the law because they're trying to kill him. Which of course was forbidden by the law. They denied that, accusing him of having a demon and acting as though they didn't know what he was talking about. Now watch how he reasons in verses 21 through 24. Jesus answered and said to them, I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses, therefore, gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, Are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. He did one work. And that's why I had Lake read from John chapter 5 earlier. That's the work to which he's referring to. When that man was by the pool of Siloam or Bethsaida, I don't remember which one now, and he was paralyzed. And when the waters were troubled, others would beat him into the pool and he couldn't get down there. And so Jesus has told the man, rise, take up your bed and walk. That's all the work Jesus did. He did that one work and they marveled, not in the sense of admiring wonder, but in the sense of shock that he would dare do such a thing. So, to what is he referring? What does he mean by all that? Well, let's follow his reasoning. He stated that Moses gave them circumcision in the law, although it didn't really originate with Moses, he said, but rather with the fathers. Excuse me. This was important enough that the Jews would perform a circumcision on the Sabbath. Now think about it. They would circumcise a man on the Sabbath. That's work. That was work. And it was certainly more work than they accused him of doing when he didn't do anything physically. He just spoke to a man, rise, take up your bed and walk. They worked on the Sabbath to obey the law of Moses on the matter of circumcision. Amazingly, they hated Jesus for making a man completely well on the Sabbath. So they could hurt a man on the Sabbath through circumcision, but he could not help a man on the Sabbath. It just didn't make sense. Therefore, he told them, oh, brethren, did we hear what he said in verse 24? He told them, not to judge according to appearance, but to judge with righteous judgment. They had not thought things through. Indeed, before we criticize someone, we need to make sure that we're not going to condemn ourselves. Because that's what they were doing. They were judging by appearance. They weren't really thinking about what he did in comparison to what they do all the time. And so they're in their condemning him, they actually condemned themselves. Now let me tell you something. Just like Jesus made that man's body well on the Sabbath, Jesus wants to make you well today. He wants to make your spirit well today on the first day of the week. Your sins eat away at the health of your soul. And you can try psychotherapy or alcohol or other things to try and heal your soul. But we all need forgiveness, which is only available through Jesus Christ. If you have sin in your soul and it's never been removed, trying anything else to get rid of it, to alleviate the pain or whatever, won't work. Only God, through Jesus Christ, can forgive us of our sin. And He's ready to do it. Are you ready to receive it? Are you ready today to die to yourself, knowing that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and you're thinking, yes, what else must I do? Well, you also need to be baptized in water. And we've got a baptistry behind me here already. We have some clothes for you to change into. Whatever needs to be done to help you, maybe it's something else, a prayer or whatever, we're ready to do it. You can come right now as we stand and sing.